WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Mary Kempton is a hero to many New York journalists. Last year, in a New Yorker profile, David Remnick wrote, "Kempton is the one true original in the business. He is surely among the greatest of all living newspapermen, and yet he is for the most part a secret west of the Hudson River." Well, maybe he'll be a bit less of a secret now with the publication of his new collection, Rebellions, Perversities, and Main Events. His subjects include Karl Marx, Ronald Reagan, mobsters, the Pope, and Bessie Smith. Kempton started writing columns for the New York Post in 1949. He left that paper in 1981 for New York Newsday, where he continues to write a column at the age of 76. He's considered somewhat of an eccentric, still biking around the city in his suit. In the introduction to his book, he writes, "Dwight D. Eisenhower once bawled him out by the numbers, and Richard Nixon once did the unmerited kindness of thanking him for being so old and valued an advisor. And Joe McCarthy lied to him, but Kempton says that was hardly a unique experience."
You know, there'd be times when he'd say, "I've got a document." You'd go up to him and say, "You know, I'm going to have a document." He'd say, "It's right back here." Then he'd come back, and there'd be no document. I mean, that's where, you know, he'd sort of lie. Mm-hmm. He lied on most things.
About John Kennedy, you write, "I have seen John Kennedy with the nuns, whose fidelity to their eternal wedlock to Christ he strained as no other mortal man could." What are you referring to there?
Well, I think that I have seen, and I do believe that nuns keep their vows, but around John F. Kennedy, they would bat their eyes. I can only interpret as somewhat flirtatious manner. But he combined everything, you see. He was a Catholic, sort of. And, of course, they were deeply involved with the idea of having a genuine Catholic president. So what I'm trying to say is, no, I mean, he was just incredibly attractive to women. Mm-hmm. Actually, he was also incredibly attractive to guys. I mean, I suppose to the extent that I have any loins, they're probably conventionally heterosexual. But I used to sit at these hearings of the Senate Rackets Committee where his brother Robert was general counsel, and every now and then Senator Kennedy would come in and sit beside him, and the sun would come in and would creep across the bones of these two guys. And I'm telling you, I remember thinking to myself, Jesus, what beauty. I mean, they were just incredibly attractive, and that's what I meant.
But you wouldn't write about this in those days, right?
I wouldn't write about their attractiveness to girls? I think I would, yes. I'd say they're immensely attractive young men.
Oh, okay.
But as to their personal lives, I don't know.
Have your standards changed about what to write about in people's personal lives? You said before that you used to be more intimate in your style of journalism. What changed you?
Well, I used to be, when I said intimate, I used to hazard guesses. You know, once, I used to do divorces all the time. And I went to see a very famous figure on the stand. And I was getting ready to make fun of him. And it suddenly occurred to me that my life had not been so impeccable that if my divorce case had, I had been on the stand and was being cross-examined, that I would have suffered greatly, that this man was suffering greatly. I got up to my feet, left, and never did a divorce case since. Now, this happened when I was quite old and had jobs and didn't have too much to worry about. But I think I was right. And I can't explain why I think I was right, but I think I was right. I mean, actually, what you should try to do in any kind of reporting, you shouldn't lie to people. You shouldn't act as though you really are more virtuous than they are. And this man was more virtuous than I was, certainly. But in any case, but you shouldn't lie to people because you have to run into them again. You shouldn't tell them, "I'm on your side. I want to hear your side of the story," or anything like that. you can do a job and you can keep your honor. And, of course, I mean, it's, you know, a friend of mine once said once that he became a columnist so he wouldn't have to call up a cop's widow and say their husband had just been shot. And I understand that. I mean, there are a lot of things you have to do in journalism that you, if they're your assignment, you do them. But if you're a columnist and have a relevant amount of freedom, then it seems to me you have far less of an excuse for just invading people's privacy and just to get ahead. But I do think that I think the worst thing you can do is to lie to somebody about being on their side, partly because you're going to run into him somewhere down the road and he's going to say, you lied to me. And if you have any shame at all, you'll feel it.
When you say lying to someone, do you mean lying to someone that and pretending like you're on their side so that they'll give you good quotes and open up to you?
And open up to me.
Hey, have you did you do that a lot in the earlier part of your career?
Well, I did a lot when I was in the South. I began to realize that this was a perfectly wonderful story, which means you would see the guy again. And I took to saying to them, don't tell me anything you wouldn't like to see printed.
This is when you were covering the civil rights movement?
Yeah. I mean, you know, sheriffs and mayors, county corporation attorneys and people like that, white establishment people, or white citizens council hacks. Because I said, look, I'm trying to keep an open mind, but when I get back and start writing, my mind will close again, and you can't trust me. So don't say anything you wouldn't want to see printed, because I may have to come back here in a month, and I don't want you telling me I was a liar. And they talk just as well. I think you almost have to do that. You have to level with the guys you're covering.
As someone who's been writing columns for decades, do you think that there are traps that columnists often fall into if they've been writing a column for a long time, and have you tried to avoid those traps yourself?
I think they're unavoidable. I think you just, I mean, I think all of us at a certain point, certainly in my age, tend to become parodies of ourselves. You have a manner. I mean, Westbrook Pegler used to refer to what he did as packaged goods, and it was a very good, is that a matter for Miss Gross? You better, whatever it is, very good image. And I think what happens is you lapse as time goes on to a series of habits. And they're very bad habits, and you really haven't got time to correct them. I think your taste improves. I hadn't thought of it this way. It's probably, you know, a consolation you don't used to have. But I remember, I mean, it seems hard to believe that I went all over the South, established a fairly good reputation. And I was drunk about 50% of the time. And when you're drunk, you really don't know that you're bad. But even when I was sober, I never knew how bad I was. I mean, I did it very carelessly. I came in from lunch, get some sort of idea. I would never do that now and just write a piece. And I was living out of town then, had to make trains. And I would write a piece in 40 or 45 minutes.
Did you think of that as part of the pose, part of the columnist's pose or the reporter's pose?
Part of the reporter's pose, yeah, I think it was. I think it was a post-war pose. Not just journalists. I think everybody drank too much. It's hard for you at your age to know how much people drank. You know, I worked a year in Italy, and I stopped drinking in Italy because Italian brandy is awful. And so I never drank whiskey because whiskey wasn't available. So I stopped drinking, and I still say that I don't drink anymore. And I drink 4 bottles of beer and 1 liter of wine a day. But I don't consider that drinking because it's not hard liquor. But I remember coming home and realizing I lived in Princeton then, and I lived in suburban circles. And I suddenly realized that all my friends, you get to about 9 o'clock at night, and I realized without naming names that most of my friends had been absolutely drunk, and I had been absolutely drunk. And we'd be having these conversations, and my voice was traveling past his ear, and his voice was traveling past my ear. And we had these two dialogues going on because we were too drunk to know what was going on.
So you don't drink hard liquor anymore, but you still drink wine and beer. Do you drink while you're working?
No. I got out of that habit and haven't since.
Mm-hmm.
No, I really drink 2 or 3 beers a day. That's about all. I drink beer at night.
Everybody who reads your book seems to have, a favorite column or something that they point to. And those favorite columns are also often about either the great political figures you've written about or mobsters that you've written about in New York. A column that I found particularly interesting isn't about somebody else. It's about you. And it's a column from 1971 about how you got mugged in New York. You had the New York Times, which you just bought in your hands, and you were taking it home to your apartment on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. And on the way, you were stopped by 2 young men with a large, old, dirty knife, and they told you to give them all your money, or they'd cut you. And tell us what you said to them.
Well, I only had 35 cents in my pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they patted me down. It was rather humiliating. And it was very, I don't know, it's an odd experience. But it shows the fundamental injustice of life. Because I was talking to somebody on Playboy about this happening. It's a very strange kind of feeling. I mean, I haven't been stuck up 10 years. But, you know, when these things happen, and you say what pops into your head. And I remember feeling very apologetic for not having any money. And then after this, which is, you know, the class differences which govern our society, Ms. Gross, I was talking to somebody in Playboy about it, and they said, well, you do a piece on this for me. So I wrote this particular piece for them. I had lost 35% cents in the stick-up, and I got $1,000 to write the piece.
Murray Kempton, his new collection is called Rebellions, Perversities, and Main Events. This is Fresh Air.